Hello and welcome back to Livewire's Rules of Investing. I'm your host and editor at Livewire, Patrick Polk. Today's guest comes to us all the way from Laguna Beach in California. Kurt Winrich is the co-CEO and portfolio manager of WCM Investment Management. WCM manages the equivalent of about 36 billion Aussie dollars for clients around the world, including over $1 billion from Australian clients. They are the investment advisor responsible for the strategy on the Contango Global Growth LIC, and they're just about to launch an exchange-traded managed fund on the ASX. Their strategy is a refreshing change from the usual high-quality businesses at a discount to intrinsic value mantra, which we're so used to hearing today. Kurt's friendly style and plentiful anecdotes made it a pleasure to host the interview, so make sure you stick around to hear the whole thing. Please don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at Livewire Markets, and check out our website, livewiremarkets.com, for all the latest investing content. I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the show, Kurt. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you, Pat. Nice to meet you too.
Now, just for a bit of background for our audience, they may not be familiar with you. Could you tell us a little bit about your firm just to get started, how much money you manage and a bit about your background, how long you've been in the industry?
Sure. We're an independent fund manager in the United States based in Southern California in a lovely beach community called Laguna Beach, about halfway between Los Angeles and San Diego on the coast. We have a staff of about 45 people. We manage about 36 billion Aussie funds under management. Most of that is in global growth stocks. We have a few other smaller things, but the vast majority is there. We're an employee-owned firm. 29 of our people are owners of the firm. So we have a great little business. We love working with each other, and we love coming around the world and sharing our story.
Excellent. Well, let's jump straight into the investing side of things because that's what we're all here for. How about we try and get a bit of an understanding of how you think about investing? So we'll start just very high level. Could you outline three of the top attributes that you're looking for in a potential investment?
Sure. We've actually thought about that a bit, and we've got some words that I'll try to define for you. But the three things are: we want to see a tailwind, we want to see an expanding moat, and we want to see an aligned culture. Those are the three ideas. Let me illustrate each with a little quick story. A tailwind is simply an idea that means that you have some kind of growth path ahead of you. We like to call this a permission to play kind of requirement. It's not very different than a lot of other people. My favorite way to illustrate it is to talk about a business that you've found that has amazing patents, it has competition going out of business, it's growing its market share, a wonderful kind of story. There's only one problem. It's 1920, the automobile's about to happen, and your company makes buggy whips. You don't have a tailwind behind you. So that's what we mean by that. An expanding moat, well, first of all, the moat, I don't know if the listeners know that, but that's an old Warren Buffett metaphor that illustrates how you think about a company. The company's like a castle. The way you keep your competition at bay is to build a moat around it. That's a shorthand for competitive advantage. So we believe that competitive advantage is important, but in a different way than a lot of people do. A lot of people just think you want the biggest, that if you go with the market share leader, for example, you've got the safer, better investment. Our contention is that you really need to pay attention to a moat that's growing. And in fact, a moat that's shrinking can be dangerous. Some of the stories I think about to illustrate that are businesses like Nokia, the phone maker from 10 years ago, on top of the world today, lost 90% of its value, doesn't even make handsets. I think way back to a business like Yahoo, trying to compete against Google. Google was the upcomer, and Yahoo was losing its edge. That's where we're talking about how moats that are expanding matter. And then the third thing I mentioned is an aligned culture. The question that we want to know is, if we find a growing moat, how do we have any confidence that it will keep growing for a long enough period to really generate some good performance? And we found the number one way that convinces us of that is that the culture is aligned to the moat. And another way to say that is we want to see a culture that encourages the behaviors that enhance the competitive position. So those are the top three things we think about: tailwind, expanding moat, aligned culture.
Great. It sounds like a winning combination. Having a look over your portfolio holdings, I noticed that there was a fairly heavy skew towards three sectors in particular, those being healthcare, technology, and consumer. Why is it that you're so exposed to these sectors, and what appeals about them to you?
Yes. Well, just think for a minute. If our objective is to find good tailwinds, long-term growth, particularly with competitive advantages that are getting stronger, there just aren't that many of them in financials and resources. Financials, it's hard for me to understand, particularly for large banks. How do you set yourself apart from your competition? My joke is to go back to the GFC days and say, the only way you can set yourself apart is by doing something tricky. And we know what happened when banks started to do something tricky. So bottom line, there aren't a lot of competitive advantages in the financial and resources sector, but they're pretty abundant in those growthy sectors of technology, healthcare, and consumer. And that's the big reason we emphasize them. We find more opportunities.
Great. Well, we talked about moats just a minute ago, and I'd like to delve into that in a little bit more detail. Moats is something that we talk about a lot here. It's pretty popular to want a strong moat. It's a pretty widely accepted idea. I think just about anything that Warren Buffett says tends to be
gospel.
Well, exactly. So could you explain in a bit more detail, I know you touched on it before, how your view of moats differs from other managers, and the specific differences? And I'd really like, if you could, to explain how it is that you actually measure those changes.
Yeah, that's a great question. So yeah, I've already said it, but I'll say it once more. The critical idea is, how is the moat changing? Is it getting stronger or is it getting weaker? But the real question, you're right, is, well, how do you know? How do you measure that? And what I like to say is that measuring the changing strength of a competitive advantage is actually pretty easy ex post, meaning after the fact. And in fact, if you want to think about it from a financial metrics perspective, it's probably most or best seen in a measurement like return on invested capital. And you think about it from a competition perspective. If you've got a very profitable business and you have protection against competitors, then your profits can continue to grow. If your competitors can attack you and copy you, your profits disappear pretty quick. That's called arbitrage. So a rising ROIC is a great ex post measure of a growing competitive advantage. There's only one problem. An ex post measure is practically useless because the good news is already in the stock price long before it shows up in the financials. So the real way to do it is to find a reliable ex ante measurement, a before the fact. And we've spent a lot of time trying to think about that. And what we settled on was sort of, we call it a simple form of pattern recognition. And it comes from studying great examples of growing competitive advantages and their life cycle in the past. So what we've done is put together and studied the great businesses of the past in sort of a case study way. And we're trying to identify and catalog the markers that tell us in a sort of contemporaneous way whether the moat is growing or shrinking. And then we see these patterns in the past. We know they're not going to repeat exactly in the future, but as Mark Twain has said, history may not repeat, but it tends to rhyme. And so we can learn something from those things. So we evaluate a prospective holding using that framework of indicators. And the idea is that if the markers are present, if the things that are associated with a growing moat are there, then we feel confident it's growing. When they disappear, we lose our confidence, and that's actually why we sell a business, is we don't see the moat growing anymore.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm curious, what is it about the traditional approach to moats that you think the consensus view has wrong? Why is it that you don't think that particular approach works, or maybe just doesn't work anymore?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think it did work long ago, 30, 40 years ago, when Warren Buffett really first started talking about this. I remember vividly in the 80s, he started buying businesses that all of his value disciples thought were insane. Like, why are you buying Coca-Cola? Why are you buying Gillette? And Warren started to talk about competitive advantages that last for years and years and years. And the fact is, when you come up with an idea that's kind of new like that, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit because people have missed that. So there was a time when it worked really well. But you already mentioned everybody talks about moats now. In fact, one of our favorite organizations is called Morningstar. We like those guys. They do a moat rating for every stock in the world. You know, so it's like, okay, what do I need to think about here? They have the moat for me. They have the DCF that tells me what it's worth. It's pretty simple. Just buy a wide moat at a discount, right? Well, if everybody's doing the same thing, there's no edge to that anymore. And besides, it also recognizes or sort of reveals a fallacy that a lot of humans succumb to. They think that they can quantify something about life, and in this case, it's about the life of a business, that is really dynamic. And it's just a shortcut to think about it statically. I've often thought about that with tax policy, for example. People will say, well, if we just tax this, we'll raise more revenue. They forget that as soon as you tax something, people behave differently, and the opportunity goes away. It's kind of like that with competitive advantages. It's too simple. It's too sort of mindless to just say, oh, I have a number. Here it is. It's a wide moat. When in fact, moats are living, breathing things. They change, and the thing to pay attention to is what's driving that change and in what direction it is.
Great. That's really interesting. It's definitely not the kind of view that you hear from every manager out there. I want to take it in a little bit of a different direction. One of the hard things, I think, for a lot of people is talking about and learning from their mistakes. I was wondering, would you be able to tell us about a time when you made a fairly significant mistake in investing, and what did you actually learn from it?
Yeah, great. How about I tell you about three mistakes I made?
Even better.
Well, the reason I'd say there's three of them is they all relate to this same idea. In fact, the idea we've been talking about. They date back like over a dozen years, but they were driven by this misunderstanding that I had about what's important about a competitive advantage. So one of them was years ago, I recommended eBay over Amazon. Those were my two choices. And I said, eBay's got the better moat. It's got more users. It's got a network effect. They're making money. Amazon wasn't making money in those days. And then here was the one that really tripped me up. They're cheaper. They look like they're less expensive. Another one that had the same pattern was I recommended Yahoo over Google. Yahoo had more users. It had an email system. It had multiple ways to monetize through both search ads and banner ads. And it was cheaper. And so I liked Yahoo over Google. The last one was I recommended Dell over Apple. This was, like I said, almost 15 years ago. Dell had huge market share. Apple had single-digit market share. Nobody wanted to use the Mac. They wanted a PC. Dell had better manufacturing, better supply chain. They were starting to expand into laptops and servers. What's not to like? And they were cheaper. So the lesson I learned was that if you look at value over and against the future growth, you're starting off on the wrong foot. And then the other big lesson was the size of their position that's based on the past is not what's important. It's where their market share or their competitive edge is going in the future. So those were hard ones for me. They made the portfolio not good. Thankfully, I learned a lesson from that. We don't make those kind of mistakes as often. We try not to make them at all, but can't say we don't. You always make mistakes, but we do a lot better.
Yeah, it's impossible to avoid mistakes altogether in investing, but I think it's what you learn from them that really can separate you from others in investing.
Yeah. So yeah, for me, those were the big ones. Don't let value deceive you into thinking you've got a safe thing, and pay attention to where the competitive advantage is going.
No, that's great. Let's get a little bit into anecdote land.
Okay.
I know that you mentioned before that culture is really core to your process, both in the companies that you're investing in, but I know also within your firm as well, culture is really important. So could you tell us a bit of a story about how you came to realize the importance of culture for investors?
Sure. Been thinking a lot about that lately because in my visits around the world, people ask about this a lot. And as I've thought about it, I realize there's probably really four sort of semi-independent paths that kind of converge to help us understand that culture is a huge differentiator between successful organizations and unsuccessful organizations. The first one that has always sort of been there is what I like to call the intuitive sense that culture matters. I think we all have it because we've probably all worked in a place where the culture was very oppressive or toxic, or there was a lot of politics, or nobody cared about each other and you were stabbed in the back, and just the bad stuff that we've had in some horrible jobs. I've had friends who've complained about how they hate their job. Why do you hate their job? All those things I listed. We just sort of intuitively knew that nobody gives their best in a situation like that. And yet you talk to somebody who loves their job and loves the way they work with people, they naturally give their best. And so it seemed sort of intuitive that if you have a business full of people that are just dying to get away from it, you're not going to have much of a good business out of that. So that one was one. Another one that sort of hit me was my experience in trying to learn how to be a great investor. And where I went was to the great investors of the past. We've already mentioned Buffett a few times. I noticed that one of Buffett's famous quotes was, "I never made a bad deal with a good person." And I, you know, me being analytical, I kind of wanted him to say, "I've never made a bad deal with a low debt company" or something. But no, he ended up talking about people. And I went, that's weird. It's really about the people that create value, isn't it? The other one that really hit home was Warren Buffett has said that the two most influential people in his investing were Benjamin Graham, which we all know, but also Phil Fisher. Phil Fisher's the author of a book called Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits, came out in the 50s. But what was interesting about it was it had a checklist in it of 15 points of how to select a great business to invest in. And again, being that analytical guy, I got all excited about a checklist. You know, I can just measure these things, put them all together, and I get the result I want. I'd been a physics guy and an engineering guy, and you do A, B, and C, and D happens, right? That's how it should work. Well, Phil's checklist blew my mind because 10 of the points on his 15-point checklist are about people and their relationships. And I began to realize that the great investors, and I'll just use Phil for the ratio, the great investor tended to think that culture, about people, their relationships with each other, their willingness to do great things for their business, was arguably twice as important as the numbers, 10 points versus 5, you know, that kind of thing. So the third one, after the intuitive sense, after seeing what the great investors did, was our own story as a company. Our company was founded over 40 years ago, but the original founder was a solo act or a one-man show, the kind of person that decided that he would make all the decisions, make all the money, own all the stock. And yet he still needed helpers to do analysis of businesses and things. So he'd hire some young people who were talented. They'd come in. They'd be excited about it because it's a fun business. And then it wouldn't take more than a few months to realize, hey, I'm not going to be part of this team. I'm not going to make any decisions. That's just how it is here. Now, you can talk about that as a culture that's fine for that solo act, but it's just never going to grow beyond being something small. And if your objective is to grow to beyond something just small and to make great things together with other people, it's never going to work. In fact, what always happens is those talented young people go right out the back door. Some of them started their own fund management firms. And within a couple of years, they were multi-billion dollar, while the original firm could never get over a few hundred million. I was part of a group that did a buyout in the late 90s, along with my partners Paul Black and David Brewer and another named Jim Owens. And we made a promise to each other at that time that we wanted to build a culture that was different, a firm that was different, that could actually grow to be something bigger and better for us than anything that could have done before. And we have a sort of a half-joking policy or practice that we said to each other, whatever the founder did about this or that other decision, we probably ought to have a good start if we do the opposite. Now, not every case, but it worked more often than you'd think. But the key idea was that by building a culture that not only attracted good people, but kept them there and let them be great and can participate, we had a flattened hierarchy. We made transparency about compensation and decisions. Everybody knew what was going on. You found that people actually loved working there. They wanted to give their best. And so that's what I think is not the cause so much, but certainly the enabler of how we've grown from a few hundred million to 36 billion today. And we have a great team and we love them. So that's the third one. The fourth one that is kind of interesting that helped converge this idea that culture makes a huge difference is that on our research on trying to understand expanding moats, we did all those case studies that I mentioned. In those case studies, we came across several situations where we would find two businesses that for all intents and purposes were the same business, and yet one outperformed the other dramatically. And we were curious, what's the difference here? Why? The business model's no different. The market's no different. What is the difference? My favorite example in the U.S. is Costco versus Sam's Club. Sam's Club is the Walmart division that's a warehouse store, the major competitor to Costco. And you find out that those businesses look the same market, but Costco's metrics are double those at Sam's Club. $1,200 per square foot at Costco, $600 of sales per square foot at Sam's. I think it's $25,000 of profits per employee at Costco, around $12,000 of profits per employee at Sam's. Those kinds of things are puzzling. It's like, what makes this difference? You start to dig into it and you start to dig into how they treat their people and you find out interesting things. The wage at Costco, the average wage, is 75% higher than the average wage at Sam's. The employee turnover rate at Sam's is around the retail average of 45%. The employee turnover rate at Costco is around 12%. You find out that 90% of Costco employees have health insurance and they only pay 10% of the cost. At Sam's, it's fewer than 50% and they have to pay 50% of the cost. So it's little wonder that employees love to work at Costco and they're not so excited about it at Sam's. And what does that mean for a business? Well, there's an old retail adage that I think is totally true. If you have happy employees, that results in happy customers. And that results in happy shareholders. And I think Costco is a beautiful example of that. And it's a beautiful example of how culture that is aligned with your competitive advantage, great customer experience is what they offer. If it's aligned and the behaviors that are encouraged by the culture enhance that, you've got yourself a magical combination. So it's those four things that got us to the point of realizing that focusing on nurturing and improving the health of a culture is probably the most important thing a business can do to keep it ahead of its competition for years and years and years.
It's funny that you bring up the example of Sam's Club and Costco.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been into either one.
Mm-hmm.
I live on the opposite side of the world to Sam's Club. There's a few Costcos around, but not many.
Mm-hmm.
Yet even having never been in either store, I'm aware of a lot of the differences you talk about, and it's widespread on the internet.
Yeah.
Everybody, regardless of whether you're from America or not, knows that Costco is a great place to work, and Sam's Club is a terrible place to work. And now, obviously, that's not going to be the same across all organizations,
right?
But it's fascinating just how far the culture can spread.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's actually something we look for. We think about culture in terms of both its alignment with the strategy. That's where we said that happy employees align with Costco's advantage. But we also think in terms of its strength. How far does it spread? Does everybody in the organization have that same cultural page that they're working from? So yeah, that's an interesting factor as well.
Yeah. Let's put ourselves in a management meeting for a second.
Yeah.
I'd be curious what are some of the questions you like to ask? It's always assessing management is something that a lot of fund managers like to talk about, but for retail investors, it can be really hard to wrap their heads around sometimes. So I was hoping you could give us a few insights and let us know some of your go-to questions that you like to use.
Sure. I'm not totally sure how these would be applicable to a retail investor because it's difficult as a retail investor to get an audience with the leadership of a company. But let me focus kind of on the culture thing because we were just on that. And I already sort of hinted a little bit at what it is we're trying to understand about cultures. There was a time when we just would approach management, this is many years ago as we were refining our process, we would approach management and just say to them, tell us about your culture. Well, that's a pretty useless question because most CEOs would reach in their top drawer, pull out a script, and read you some nonsense thing that didn't mean anything. So we went back to the drawing board, sought some help from academicians, I can say that word. We went to a Harvard Business School prof named James Heskett, who helped us understand how to tease out better information about alignment of culture, which was a big deal for us, how to tease out information about strength of culture, which I already hinted at, which to us means does everybody buy into it, and to tease out the third big thing we think is important, how adaptable is this culture? Are they willing to change and grow, even perhaps at the expense of disrupting their own business? So those are the things we're looking for. One of our favorite ways to get at a couple of those, which I'd call the alignment and the strength, is to ask questions, these two. We ask leadership, and then, of course, the big deal for us is we've got to go and ask a lot of employees the same couple of questions, is what's sacred at your business? And what's taboo at your business? So we went to a place like Amazon and asked up to 30 different people, including some of the leadership, what's sacred, what's taboo? And the answers we got were what's sacred is customer satisfaction, a great user experience. What's taboo is waste of any kind. Now, that's one thing to learn what those things seem to be. That tells you, are they aligned with the competitive advantage that an Amazon has? And I think they are, because Amazon's competitive advantage is convenience, good prices, quick delivery, just so simple that it's painless, right? But the other thing that it reveals is that when we interviewed close to 30 people about that, some of them former employees, we got the same answer across almost every one of them. And that told us that this culture is in the DNA, so to speak, of the people there. And when it's in the DNA, it reflects who they really are. And if who they really are helps the competitive advantage, then you've got just a wonderful situation. So those are two that we think is really useful to ask. What's sacred? What's taboo?
Sounds great. One more kind of softer question for you. What would you, we may have touched on this a little bit earlier, actually, yeah. I'm wondering. I'm taking a bit of a stab there, but yeah. I'm wondering if we've already discussed this a little bit. What's your favorite investing book?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I maybe spilled the beans, but there are several, of course, that you love. I mean, I'll put a plug in for Barton Biggs' Hedgehogging, a great story. Some of the books that examine the GFC are really interesting. Even going all the way back, Michael Lewis is one of my favorite authors, even going all the way back to Liar's Poker, but certainly The Big Short and those things. Great. But if I had to narrow it down to one, it probably would be Phil Fisher's Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits, the one with the 15-point checklist I mentioned. And, you know, the lessons that I got out of that were really why I go back to it as my favorite, were the idea that in every great business, it's the factors concerning the quality of people that are really the most important. And the other thing is that to really know which businesses have an edge, you've really just got to do that in the trenches research that is not getting more numbers, but it's just talking to people who know the business. And that's why we use a large network around the world to talk to current employees, former employees, customers, vendors, competitors, asking questions about competitive advantage and culture. Phil called it scuttlebutt research, and I think that's a lesson I learned. That's critical. You can't do it without that.
Great. Well, we've got a few regular questions that we like to ask all of our guests. One of our key objectives for the podcast is to teach the audience something that they hadn't thought about before. Could you tell us about something important that investors aren't thinking about right now? It could be a risk, a strategy, a cognitive bias, an opportunity, whatever you like.
Sure. One of the things about our firm is that we are so focused on finding great companies that we don't think a lot about macro or what's happening in the world. But we do think a lot about a cognitive bias that I think everybody succumbs to. And we sum it up in three little words. Our advice is ignore the pessimists. I think human beings are just sort of naturally wired. Maybe it's the flight or fight instinct, but we're naturally wired to look at everything about life and what can go wrong. And we tend to miss what is good, which dominates most of the time. But gosh, you watch the news these days, all you see is there's a crisis here, this is about to fall apart. That's all you get. And yet when you look back over the 20th century and into the 21st, you find out things actually end up working out really well. Now, I'd been given a clue that you might ask that, so I actually looked up something that I would love to share with you as just a quotation from one of my favorite commentators. It's an American named Nick Murray. And he wrote this about 6 months ago. I don't know, here's some dates for you. 6 months ago was October of 2017. And it turns out that October 9th of 2007, 10 years before that, was the peak of the market before the GFC, right? And so here's what Nick said as celebrating the 10-year anniversary of the peak of the market. He said, imagine that Dr. Doom, the perceived best analyst in the business, told you on that night of the market peak that financial authorities would allow mark-to-market accounting rules to burn the banking system to the ground, with many well-known financial firms failing or being taken over by the government. You knew the unemployment rate was going to soar to 10%, we're talking in America, and the economy would experience the deepest recession since the 1930s. You also knew the U.S. would soon elect a president that would socialize much more of the healthcare system, raise top income tax rates, and push the Medicare tax for high income earners up by an additional 4%. Finally, you knew that 10 years later, all of those new taxes and expanded healthcare policies would still be in place. Then imagine you knew the federal debt would be more than 100% of GDP, with massive annual deficits predicted as far as the eye could see. Then imagine you were allowed one investment choice, a choice you had to stick to for the next 10 years, through thick and thin, no reallocation allowed. Put all your investable assets in the stock market, a 10-year treasury note, gold, oil, housing, or cash. Pick just one of those assets and let your investment ride. Which asset would you have picked? Be honest, in that environment, with that kind of foresight, right at a stock market peak, it would have been awfully tough to pick stocks. And yet, on the basis of total return, over the last 10 years, stocks are the asset that did the best. Assuming no major shift in the weeks ahead of this little comment that he wrote, the S&P 500 stocks has generated a total return of 7.2% per year. Gold did well, but lagged. It was about 5.5 a year. 10-year treasury note was about 4.5. Oil was down 4% a year. Home prices increased about 1% a year, and cash averaged 0.5%. You might have slept better by investing in the treasury notes. Certainly the volatility of stocks and the cascade of news headlines predicting doom and gloom wouldn't have bothered you as much, but you'd have fewer total assets today than you would have if you'd kept the faith and stayed with stocks. And if you wanted to reinvest now for the next 10 years in the bonds, you'd get about 2%. So if you knew exactly when to buy and sell each of these investments, you could have done better, but no one did that and no one knew how to do it. So what's our point? You would have been better off by ignoring all the pessimists who became famous during the GFC, investing in companies, allowing world-class managers to use your money to build wealth, was once again the best investment strategy. 10 years on, we still think that's true.
That's so powerful. Of course, in Australia, a lot of people like to talk about the fact that the ASX 200 is still below its peak from 10 years ago. The problem is they're ignoring a big part of the returns. And in Australia, it's so heavily dividend focused that a huge part of your total return comes from dividends. When you actually look at, when you start including the dividends and looking at total returns, it's a totally different story. Much like in the US, the total return index is far above where it was at the peak of the GFC.
And even more to the point that you're making, think about it globally, not just in Australia. Yeah. As we started off this talk by pointing out that there are more great competitive advantages in healthcare, consumer, and tech, guess what? That's becoming bigger and bigger in the global GDP picture, which means it's bigger and bigger in the global markets. And that kind of thing is going to keep going. It's going to have fits and starts and recessions, sure. That's how economics goes. But what I can say with some level of confidence is that the emerging middle class is going to continue to see disposable income increase over the next 10, 20, 30 years. And as a result, those sectors, consumer, healthcare, and tech, are going to become bigger and bigger parts of every economy. And if you want to invest well, you need to participate in that.
Cool. All right. Well, let's go back in time for a second.
Yeah.
If only we could. if you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university, we call it university here, I believe it's college in the US,
yeah.
And give yourself one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
You know, it's funny. There's a lot of stories I could tell about that. I came out of engineering into the investment world. I was pretty sure, being the cocky young kid that I was, that investing was just another engineering problem and that I could solve it with just sufficient data and computing power. So hilarious when I think back. So the advice I'd give myself is don't waste so much time trying to do what everyone else is doing, especially in trying to quantify everything about a great business or great investing.
That's great. Well, one last one for you. If the market were to close for 5 years starting from tomorrow, and you could only own in shares in one company. Now, we don't actually expect people to do this.
Yeah.
So I always like to put a warning, don't try this at home.
Yeah.
It is supposed to be a bit of a thought experiment.
Sure.
But which company would it be?
Well, as I thought about this, you know, that's obviously a hard decision. And to your point exactly, I would never recommend anyone put all their eggs in one basket. On the other hand, I would say I don't recommend that people have too many baskets. I think a couple, three dozen is the right number. In fact, in our portfolio, that's what we have, is between 30 and 40 stocks, about three dozen. Nevertheless, if you forced me to do it, I'd probably say Amazon is the thing I'd hold for the next 5 years and not worry about it. And it's because I think that the way that commerce is changing around the world, the way that we buy and sell consumer goods, is still in the real early innings, and Amazon is the vanguard. I don't know if you know this, but in ex-China, Amazon is 50% of the growth in retail spending around the world. Not the total retail spending, don't get me wrong. But if you take China out, which is all about Alibaba, Amazon's 50% of the growth. It's crazy. And that's the way consumer spending's going. So I'd feel pretty comfortable saying, put my money there, wake up in 5 years, and it should be okay.
If I'm not mistaken, I think in the US it's actually more like 100% of retail growth, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
Incredible stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. In fact, now 50% of the people that do e-commerce in the US say they start their search at Amazon. It was 30% only 5 years ago. 2 years ago, it was 40. Now it's 50% of the people surveyed say, yeah, I just go to Amazon. Then I look around. It's crazy.
Crazy stuff. Well, I got a bit of work to do here first, but I'm sure they'll catch up with the US. Kurt, look, it's been lovely to chat with you. Thanks for sharing your insight. I hope you enjoy your trip to Australia.
Thank you, Pat. It's great to be here.
Well, that's it for another week of The Rules of Investing. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Our next guest is none other than Alex Weislitz, founder of Thorney Investments. Alex has been called Australia's Warren Buffett, though he's quick to brush off the comparison. It's not hard to see the parallels, though, particularly when you compare how Thorney Opportunities Limited started life with the beginning of Warren Buffett's involvement with Berkshire. He started Thorney with a little over $1 million in the early 90s, and today he's worth over $1 billion. By my calculations, that's over 30% per annum, though he only admits to around 20%. It's one of the first times he's ever provided an in-depth look at his investment process, so don't miss it. In the meantime, don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at LiveWire Markets, and visit our website, livewiremarkets.com, for all the latest investing content. And as always, thanks for listening.